the existence of a tape. Rather, he wrote in his dossier that a man in Trump's 2013 Miss Universe pageant entourage spoke out of turn to a Russian source Steele had reason to trust. Another possible corroborator is Aras Agalarov, father of Emin. A Western diplomat in Moscow, speaking to the Daily Mail, observed that, "If there are skeletons in Trump's dealings with Russia, Aras is the man who will know where they are." Just 3 days after Steele's dossier was published, NBC News called Steele a real-life James Bond, quoting tradecraft expert Nigel West. Multiple active-duty CIA officers responsible for the case file on this incident, speaking to the BBC's Russia correspondent through an intermediary, say that the recording does indeed exist. BBC reporter Paul Wood reports that at least one allied European intelligence agency has the same information. These officers also tell the BBC that there is at least one other recording of Trump of a sexual nature from a different location, St. Petersburg, and a different time. Any such recording would be considered national security endangering kompromat, potential blackmail material, if it is now in the possession of the Kremlin. Keith Darden, an international relations professor at American University who has studied the Russian use of kompromat, described to The New Yorker in July 2018 the political environment in Russia as being one where kompromat is routinely used to curry favor, improve negotiated outcomes, and sway opinion. Intelligence services, business people, and political figures everywhere exploit gossip and damaging information. Darden even coined the term the blackmail state to describe the uniquely powerful role kompromat has in the former Soviet Union and how pervasive it is. In September 2017, a Russian hotel industry source told The Guardian, "If you are in their field of interest, then the FSB will absolutely attempt to carry out surveillance. In the bigger hotels, you also definitely have a number of people on the staff who work on the side for the FSB, so they would have had absolutely no problem getting into the room if necessary." Added the source, "I'm pretty sure Trump would have been of a sufficient level to warrant surveillance. I've seen people of lower levels than him watched in their hotel rooms for sure." If Trump has been caught up in Russia's blackmail state, the implications for America's national security are significant. Whether the material is of a personal or financial nature or both, it throws into doubt the authenticity of Trump's Russia policy, which includes characterizing Putin in glowing terms, refusing to denounce the Russian strongman's role in the murder of journalists, opposing sanctions on Russia, challenging the authority and viability of NATO in a manner that echoes Kremlin propaganda, advocating Russia's immediate return to the G7, and remaining open to acknowledging Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea. Chapter 4. The Campaign Begins, 2013 to 2015. Summary. Not long after the 2012 presidential election, the Russians begin preparations for 2016, dispatching two spies to the United States with the goal of infiltrating the right-wing National Rifle Association, NRA, and ultimately creating a back channel between the Kremlin and top leaders in the Republican Party. At the same time, the Kremlin becomes more aggressive in its efforts to reach out to Donald Trump, as the signs that he is going to run for president are, by mid-2013, unmistakable. The Kremlin is successful in its plans to infiltrate the NRA, as well as in its efforts to push Trump toward a foreign policy more favorable to Russia by dangling Moscow land development deals in front of him. It is unclear as of 2015 whether the Kremlin plans to simply influence NRA brass into contributing a record amount of money to Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, or whether it wants to funnel illegal campaign contributions directly to Trump through the organization. In 2018, Special Counsel Robert Mueller will investigate both possibilities. What will be clear by Election Day is that an unprecedented amount of NRA money was essential to the success of Trump's presidential run. As soon as Trump announces his candidacy on June 16, 2015, at Trump Tower in New York City, he begins lauding Putin, denigrating sanctions on Russia, and harping on the need for better relations with the Kremlin, even as a longtime business partner of his with ties to both the Kremlin and the Russian mafia is trying to help him parlay his pro-Russia foreign policy into a sizable payday in the Russian real estate market. Meanwhile, both Trump and his son Donald Trump Jr. strengthen their bonds with the NRA, which will, in May 2016, issue an unusually early endorsement of Trump, a full 6 months before Election Day. As the Weekly Standard will note in February 2017, there are many claimants to the honor of having nudged Donald Trump over the top in the presidential election. But the folks with the best case are the National Rifle Association and the consultants who made their TV ads.
The facts. From 2013 through the end of 2017, Alexander Torshin, Russian name Alexander Porfiryevich Torshin, a Russian politician with ties to Putin's intelligence services, and Maria Butina, a 20-something Russian student who will eventually be charged with conspiracy and acting as a foreign agent, seek to infiltrate the NRA as part of a plot to create a back channel between the Kremlin and top leaders in the Republican Party. The tripartite plot involves making a social connection with powerful NRA members and GOP operatives, creating a bogus gun rights organization in Russia to create sympathy of purpose with American gun owners, and finally, encouraging the NRA to give generously to one candidate in particular, Donald Trump. As related by Rolling Stone in April 2018, Torshin is a member of Putin's political party with close ties to Russia's internal security service, the FSB, which awarded him a medal in 2016. According to the CIA's former Russian operations chief, Stephen Hall, Putin decided Mr. Torshin was going to be the guy to do it for him. It being, as Rolling Stone phrases it, exploiting the American gun lobby. That exploitation involves forging a quick friendship between NRA President David Keane and a Russian sister organization to the NRA, despite the fact that, as Hall puts it, the idea of private gun ownership is anathema to Putin. As Torshin is working on connecting the Kremlin to powerful NRA members and, later on, Republican politicians, prosecutors in Spain, who, according to Bloomberg, refer to Torshin as a Russian mafia boss, are investigating him for money laundering. In May 2018, Spanish officials, still suspecting Torshin of involvement in money laundering and organized crime, will turn over wiretaps from their investigation to the FBI, saying publicly of the recordings, on which Torshin is referred to by Alexander Romanov, a mob-linked former Russian banker, as El Padrino, meaning godfather, that Mr. Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., should be concerned. Prosecutors eventually decide not to charge Torshin, not for lack of evidence, but because they do not believe the Kremlin would extradite him to Spain. In 2013, the then 24-year-old Maria Butina begins a romantic relationship with the then 54-year-old Paul Erickson, an influential GOP operative and NRA member. According to a July 2018 Mother Jones summary of NRA-Russia collusion and subsequent indictments against Butina, Butina was hoping, through Erickson, to establish a back channel between the Kremlin and the Republican leadership. In short order, she is cohabiting with Erickson, and Erickson has begun paying many of her expenses through a company established for this exclusive purpose called Bridges LLC. By the fall of 2013, Erickson has assisted Butina in getting close to NRA President David Keane. In November, Butina and Torshin host Keane in Moscow. In January 2014, Keane publishes an essay by Torshin in the Washington Times, where Keane is editor of the opinion pages. Torshin and Butina join Keene for meetings at the 2014 NRA convention in Indianapolis, Indiana, and in the fall of 2014, Erickson travels to Moscow with Butina for a gun rights event. In February 2015, Trump declines to renew his contract with the NBC reality show The Apprentice, confirming something that has been an open secret in GOP circles since 2013, that he plans a run for the presidency. The assumption that Trump will seek the White House in 2016 is predicated in part on statements made by Trump to Republican leaders in New York in December 2013, at which point he predicted he would begin his presidential run in 2015. In March 2015, both Trump and Torshin attend the annual NRA conference in Nashville, Tennessee, and have a jovial exchange, according to Torshin. Butina is also at the conference and has a private meeting with a political candidate. It is not known if the candidate was Trump. Torshin leaves the 2015 NRA conference considering himself now an acquaintance of Trump's. On November 8, 2015, he will tweet from his personal Twitter account in response to allegations of racism against Trump, "I know Donald Trump through NRA. He is a decent person." In 2017, Torshin will secure an invite to the National Prayer Breakfast and a spot on the president's schedule afterward for a private audience. According to five sources who spoke to Yahoo News, Trump's team cancels the post-prayer breakfast Trump-Torshin meeting because Torshin is suspected of being a godfather in the Russia mafia. The White House will later say that no such meeting was ever scheduled. Trump will deny having ever met Torshin. From the moment Trump formally announces his presidential candidacy on June 16, 2015, he tends to discuss two topics with great regularity. First, how good he will be at getting along with the Russians and making deals with them. Second, how well he knows Vladimir Putin, and moreover, Putin's perspective on whom he can and whom he wants to make deals with. On July 11, 2015, less than a month after he announces his candidacy, Trump is at a libertarian event in Las Vegas called Freedom Fest, conducting a Q&A session. He calls on a young woman from Russia, Maria Butina, who says she'd like to know Trump's position on sanctions and also what sort of relationship he would like to have with Putin and Russia if he is elected president. The press conference is being recorded. Trump answers her question by saying, "I know Putin, and I'll tell you what, we get along with Putin. Putin has no respect for President Obama. Big problem. Big problem. I believe I would get along very nicely with Putin. I don't think you'd need the sanctions. I think that we would get along very, very well. I really believe that." Trump also expresses the view that the United States has driven Russia and China together with the big oil deals that are being made, the implication being that it would be better for Russian oil to flow westward rather than eastward, and that the anti-Russia policies of the Obama administration have engendered greater Russian-Chinese cooperation. 10 days after he says at a televised event that he opposes sanctions on Russia, Trump receives an invitation to come to Moscow from Aras Agalarov. The invitation, communicated by Emin Agalarov's publicist Rob Goldstone to Trump's secretary, is ostensibly for Aras's birthday party in November 2015, but contains a promise that Trump can meet with Putin in person if he comes to the party. Goldstone tells Trump's secretary that Emin will set up the meeting with Putin if Trump agrees to it. Within 60 days of Trump's telling Butina at Freedom Fest that he doesn't see the need for sanctions on Russia, longtime Trump business partner and Russian mafia-linked fixer Felix Sater approaches Trump's attorney Michael Cohen with a new business opportunity. Sater has been promising Trump a new Moscow tower deal since 2005, but has been unable to deliver. Now he has a willing investor by the name of Andrei Rozov. Sater and Rozov have both been on the executive board of a Moscow real estate company called Mirax Group since 2008, but until Trump announces he is running for president, Rozov betrays no interest in partnering with Trump. Now, he agrees to let Sater approach Cohen with the idea. Sater follows a September email proposing the idea to Cohen and Trump with an October email that contains both a signed letter of intent from Rozoff and a note from Sater saying that Trump's agreeing to build a Trump World Tower Moscow would possibly fix relations between the countries, Russia and the United States. It appears that at least the September communication between Sater and Cohen was kept from everyone at the Trump Organization but Trump. On September 30, 2015, Alan Garten, the chief legal officer of the Trump Organization, tells ABC News that there's really no direct relationship between Sater and the Trump Organization, and I don't know that he ever brought any deals. The statement is false. In October 2015, while Cohen is communicating with Sater on a Trump Tower Moscow deal, even as his client, Donald Trump, runs for president, Cohen receives yet another offer from Russia, Trump's third since 2013 at a minimum, to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. The proposal comes from Russian billionaire Sergei Gordiev, whom the Washington Post calls a Moscow real estate mogul who served through 2010 as a Russian legislator. Gordiev indicates, through an intermediary, an international financier Gordiev had worked with in the past, Georgi Retskiladze, according to the Post, that the deal he's offering Trump would involve a Trump-branded residential development. In October 2015, Gordiev and Retskiladze send Cohen a 13-page proposal and pictures of the prospective site. Cohen turns down the request only because, as he explains to Retskiladze, Trump is already working on a deal for a Trump Tower in Moscow. Sater tells Cohen in his note in October that we, Sater and Cohen, will help Putin agree on the message the construction of the tower is intended to embody, that commerce and business are much better and more practical than politics. Sater tells Cohen and Trump that the goal of this deal is to help world peace and make a lot of money. What exactly Trump must do to help world peace in order to make a lot of money is not specified in Sater's note, but when Trump mentions Russia on the campaign trail, much of the time he emphasizes the need to get along with Moscow and, more particularly, to make deals with Putin that would include eliminating sanctions against Russia. It is the fifth month of his presidential campaign. On November 3rd, Sater writes Cohen to say, I know how to play it, and we will get this done. Buddy, our boy can become president of the United States of America, and we can engineer it. I will get all of Putin's team to buy in on this. By the time he sends this note, Sater has lined up financing for the Trump-Rozoff Tower with VTB, a then-sanctioned Kremlin-owned bank. The next month, however, new sanctions are leveled against VTB, meaning that unless Trump wins the presidency and removes U.S. sanctions on Russia, he will not be able to get the money that Sater has secured for him. Sater, knowing the connection between Trump's Russia policy and his ability to get a Trump Tower Moscow approved by the Kremlin, adds in his November 2015 email to Cohen that he is eager to show video clips to his Russian contacts of instances of Mr. Trump speaking glowingly about Russia, and he would arrange for Mr. Putin to praise Mr. Trump's business acumen. If he, Putin, says it, we own this election, Sater writes Cohen. America's most difficult adversary agreeing that Donald is a good guy to negotiate with. Sater's view is that Trump announcing, and Putin implicitly blessing, a Trump Tower Moscow in late 2015 or early 2016 will help propel Trump's presidential campaign forward. It is the most explicit juxtaposition of politics and business that any of Trump's business associates have proposed to date. In January 2016, however, that mark will be bested, as Cohen contacts Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin's spokesman, to directly ask for the Kremlin's help with Trump's Trump Tower Moscow deal with Rozoff.
that Cohen is seeking Kremlin assistance on a financial transaction even as Trump is pushing his pro-Russia foreign policy with voters, and that Trump has chosen to hide this transaction not only from voters but even from many at his own company, is an indication that Trump and his team are working on two tracks with the hope that each will reinforce the other. By late 2015, Torshin is hosting two dinners in Moscow for a high-level NRA delegation that includes NRA President David Keene, top NRA donor Joe Gregory, NRA board member Pete Brownell, and Sheriff David A. Clark, a Trump supporter who will later become a key Trump surrogate. They are joined at one of their dinners by Dmitry Rogozin, a hardline deputy to Putin who is at the time and still is under U.S. sanctions. During the delegation's visit, members are also introduced, according to reporting by McClatchy, to other influential Russian government and business figures. In December 2015, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who has been advising Donald Trump and four other GOP candidates on national security issues for at least 2 months, goes to a gala in Moscow in celebration of the Kremlin's media outlet, RT, for whom Flynn works as an analyst. He is seated immediately to the right of Putin. Former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, will later tell NBC News, "Of course, it is not coincidence that General Flynn was placed next to President Putin. Flynn was considered a close Trump advisor. Why else would they want him there?" Flynn will subsequently fail to report any of his income from the event, approximately $40,000. One of the other candidates Flynn is advising is Ben Carson. One of Carson's national security advisors is George Papadopoulos. Papadopoulos will be hired as a member of Trump's national security team after an interview with Trump campaign co-chair Sam Clovis at a time when Flynn and a just-hired Jeff Sessions, Republican Alabama, constitute the entirety of the Trump campaign's national security apparatus. In 2016, the annual NRA conference is held in Louisville, Kentucky, and once again, Torshin and Butina attend. A few days before the conference, Butina's boyfriend, Erickson, writes Trump campaign aide Rick Dearborn to inform the Trump campaign that the Kremlin is quietly but actively seeking a dialogue with the United States that isn't forthcoming under the current administration, adding that the Kremlin believes that the only possibility of a true reset in this relationship would be with a new Republican in the White House. Erickson notes that Torshin will attempt to make first contact with the Trump campaign at the NRA convention. Erickson adds, "Putin is deadly serious about building a good relationship with Mr. Trump. He wants to extend an invitation to Mr. Trump to visit him in the Kremlin before the election." At the same time that Torshin approaches Dearborn through Erickson, he also uses Rick Clay, whom the New York Times describes as an advocate for conservative Christian causes, to get the same message to Dearborn. Putin wants to meet with Trump, and Torshin wants to meet with Trump first to set up the meeting. Dearborn sends the email from Clay on to Jared Kushner, who nixes the idea, according to two sources interviewed by the New York Times. It is unknown whom else, if anyone, Dearborn or Kushner passed the email to after reading it, but in fact, Torshin does end up dining with Donald Trump Jr. at the NRA convention several days later. Per Vanity Fair, Trump Jr.'s attorney, Alan Feuerfass, says the two men engaged in no more than gun-related small talk. But according to McClatchy and the New York Times, Torshin was in fact trying to set up a one-on-one meeting with candidate Trump at an event honoring wounded veterans being hosted at a location near the convention. He even told the campaign he was bringing a gift to the event for Melania. NRA expenditures on the 2016 presidential primaries and general election were far higher than the NRA initially reported, and eventually reach and exceed $70 million, according to a McClatchy report in January 2018. The figure is a record-shattering one for the NRA. Trump,
who had originally promised voters he would spend $1 billion of his own money on his campaign, by the end of the primary season has spent only about 6.5% of that total, while paying his own companies $12 million from his campaign coffers in reimbursements for travel, lodging, meals, and other services. In May 2016, upon clinching the nomination, he announces that he will not be financing his general election campaign and will take funds from the Republican National Committee, RNC, instead. Massive spending by the NRA and the RNC on Trump's behalf make it possible for him to abandon his self-funding promise for the primary and nevertheless be adequately funded for the November election. In the end, the NRA spends more than the billionaire Trump does on his own election. The FBI and Special Counsel Robert Mueller will eventually reveal they have initiated an investigation into whether Torshin and Butina had any effect on the NRA's remarkable outlay of funds on Trump's behalf. Torshin will later be sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department, and Butina will be indicted. As noted by Vanity Fair in June 2018, the FBI and Special Counsel Robert Mueller are investigating meetings between NRA officials and powerful Russian operatives, trying to determine if those contacts had anything to do with the gun group spending $30 million in direct support to help elect Donald Trump, triple what it invested on behalf of Mitt Romney in 2012. The use of foreign money in American political campaigns is illegal. On October 4, 2016, just a month before the presidential election, Paul Erickson writes an email to an acquaintance that reads, "Unrelated to specific presidential campaigns, I've been involved in securing a very private line of communication between the Kremlin and key GOP leaders through, of all conduits, the NRA." Annotated history. From the moment Trump formally announces his presidential candidacy on June 16, 2015, he tends to discuss two topics with great regularity. First, how good he will be at getting along with the Russians and making deals with them. Second, how well he knows Vladimir Putin and, moreover, Putin's perspective on whom he can and whom he wants to make deals with. In an interview with Fox News host Bill O'Reilly in June 2015, Trump remarked, "I was over in Moscow 2 years ago, and I will tell you, you can get along with those people and get along with them well. You can make deals with those people. Obama can't." It is unclear how Trump knew in June 2015 the ease with which he personally could make deals with the Russians and that Obama could not. One explanation comes in an interview with Sean Hannity 3 days after Trump's conversation with O'Reilly. When asked if he's ever had contact with Vladimir Putin, Trump answers yes, and adds, "I was there 2 years ago, and I got to meet everybody." When Hannity pressed Trump to confirm that he'd spoken to Putin during the pageant, Trump replied cryptically, "I don't want to say," repeating that answer twice. He also guaranteed that Putin hated Obama, though once again, he wouldn't confirm whether the information had come from Putin himself. The next month, the same month as Freedom Fest, Trump told CNN's Anderson Cooper with respect to Putin, "I get along with him fine. He hates Obama. He doesn't respect Obama. He has no respect for Obama. Has a hatred for Obama." Perhaps most telling was a comment Trump made to Cooper about how, as president, he would work to terminate former NSA contractor Edward Snowden's continued asylum in Russia. "If I'm president, Putin says to Snowden, 'Hey, boom, you're gone from Russia. I guarantee you this.'" Trump's 2015 comments assuring American voters that he had met with Putin and indeed knew his mind on presidential politics at a time when Trump was himself running for president are so voluminous that only a few of them can be compiled here. On July 15, 2015, Trump told Hannity, "Putin has no respect for President Obama." On July 26, 2015, he wrote on Twitter,
Putin knows that Obama is a danger to the world. Putin will respect President Trump. At a July 30, 2015 presser at his golf course in Scotland, he observed that Putin hates Obama. A March 2017 CNN compendium of Trump-Putin quotes also reveals that Trump assured American voters he would get along with Putin during events on June 16th and 29th, telling the City Club of Chicago, "I had the Miss Universe over there in Russia 2 years ago. I got to know these guys well. We can get along with them well. We can get along with them well." July 8th, 26th, and 30th, August 12th, 14th, 20th, 23rd, and 29th, and September 23rd. As related by Rolling Stone in April 2018, Torshin is a member of Putin's political party with close ties to Russia's Internal Security Service, the FSB, which awarded him a medal in 2016. According to a May 2018 NPR article, Torshin had spent years of travel, dating back to 2009, cultivating ties with American conservatives. The article quotes Steve Hall, a retired CIA chief of Russian operations. "Vladimir Putin, and probably the Russian intelligence services, saw Torshin's connections as something that they could leverage in the United States. They reach out to a guy like Torshin and say, 'Hey, can you make contact with the NRA and some other conservatives so that we can have connectivity from Moscow into those conservative parts of American politics should we need them?' And that's basically just wiring the United States for sound, if you will, in preparation for whatever they might need down the road." NPR reported that Torshin took a trip to Alaska in 2009 seeking an audience with Sarah Palin, a request he communicated to the Alaska governor's office through Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. While Palin did not meet with Torshin, government records indicate that Alaska's Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell, now the state's governor, was slated to meet with Torshin in her stead. He now says that he does not recall the meeting. Some of Torshin's U.S. activities puzzle observers. In March 2015, he gave a speech in Washington, D.C. in his capacity as the deputy governor of the Bank of Russia, and one attendee, a former U.S. official, told NPR that, "For anyone at the lunch who's remotely familiar with finance or the world of central banking, Torshin demonstrated no significant expertise in either realm." Within 60 days of Trump's telling Butina at Freedom Fest that he doesn't see the need for sanctions on Russia, longtime Trump business partner and Russian mafia-linked fixer Felix Sater approaches Trump's attorney Michael Cohen with a new business opportunity. Sater has been promising Trump a new Moscow Tower deal since 2005, but has been unable to deliver. Now, he has a willing investor by the name of Andrei Rozov. Sater and Rozov have both been on the executive board of a Moscow real estate company called Mirax Group since 2008. But until Trump announces he is running for president, Rozov betrays no interest in partnering with Trump. Now, he agrees to let Sater approach Cohen with the idea. Cohen and Sater are childhood friends from Brighton Beach, also known as Little Odessa, in the southern portion of the New York City borough of Brooklyn, where Sater's father was a small-time crime boss, and Cohen, a boy who admired the area's many Russian emigre gangs from afar. By 2015, Cohen had become Trump's most loyal foot soldier. As reported by Business Insider in April 2018, Cohen once said, "If you do something wrong," to Mr. Trump, "I'm going to come at you, grab you by the neck, and I'm not going to let go until I'm finished." It's no surprise, then, that Cohen has been called Trump's pit bull and told Vanity Fair in a September 2017 article that, "I'm the guy who would take a bullet for the president. I'd never walk away." Cohen, who attended what Politico calls the worst law school in America, was found by a judge reviewing his client records to have only three clients: Sean Hannity, GOP fundraiser Elliot Broidy, and Donald Trump. The Republican National Committee named Broidy a deputy finance chair of the RNC alongside Cohen in April 2017, while Hannity acted as a Trump advisor during the 2016 campaign and has continued to advise him throughout Trump's presidency. Broidy would eventually be caught in a hush money payoff of a former mistress, almost identical in its mechanism and its secrecy to the one Cohen pleaded guilty to orchestrating on Donald Trump's behalf in August 2018, with Broidy's mistress using the same Cohen-recommended attorney to negotiate her payment from Broidy that one of Trump's mistresses used to get a $130,000 payment from Trump. According to a March 2018 New York Times article, a witness cooperating with Robert Mueller in the Trump-Russia investigation, George Nader, has revealed to the special counsel a year-long effort to turn Broidy into an instrument of influence at the White House for the rulers of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The article says, hundreds of pages of correspondence between the two men reveal an active effort to cultivate President Trump on behalf of the two oil-rich Arab monarchies. High on the agenda of the two men is repeatedly pressing the president to meet privately outside the White House with the leader of the UAE. The Times further reports Nader offering Broidy more than $1 billion in contracts for the latter's private security company in exchange for preferred access to Trump by the UAE and its agents, including Nader. It is not yet known what, if any, conversations Trump's attorney Cohen had with Broidy about the UAE when Cohen was representing Broidy and both men were Trump-appointed deputy finance chairs at the Republican National Committee. Cohen's tiny client roster is partly explained by the fact that he was, for a long time, also an executive vice president at the Trump Organization. In testimony before the House Intelligence Committee in December 2017, Donald Trump Jr. explained his belief that, in conversations among executives at Trump Tower, as long as one of the people in the room is a lawyer, or, as applicable, also a lawyer in addition to being a Trump Organization executive, anything said in the room is covered by attorney-client privilege. All that is required, per Trump Jr.'s testimony, is that there be a lawyer in the room during the discussion. This is, of course, incorrect. In September 2015, per an ABC News report from August 2017, Felix Sater approached Cohen with what he called a signature development opportunity. A chance to build a Trump Tower in Moscow separate from the one Trump had previously agreed to build and was still under a letter of intent to build in Moscow's Crocus City complex with the Agalarovs. At the end of that September, reported ABC, Trump Organization officials told ABC News that Sater inflated his connections to the company. Alan Garten, a senior Trump Organization attorney, told ABC that there's really no direct relationship between Sater and the Trump Organization. To be honest, I don't know that he ever brought any deals, Garten said. Garten's statement was inaccurate at best and dishonest at worst. Not only had Sater helped secure partners for Trump's Trump Soho project, one of the most important projects of Trump's career, but he'd also sent a number of Russian oligarchs in Trump's direction. Whoever told Garten to deny Sater's long-standing relationship with the Trump Organization and his ongoing value to Trump's bottom line was presumably anxious to forestall public discovery of that arrangement should Sater's long-awaited Moscow deal finally bear fruit, as looked to be the case by September 2015. According to ABC, Cohen kept Sater's proposal from everyone at the Trump Organization but Trump. Several weeks later, on October 13, 2015, Sater emailed Cohen saying that he'd secured an investor for his proposal and was enclosing, for Trump's signature, a letter of intent. Sater had appended a note to the letter of intent that read in full, according to a September 8, 2017 story by New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman, "Dear Michael, attached is the signed LOI, letter of intent, by Andrei Rozov. Please have Mr. Trump countersign, signed, and sent back. Let's make this happen and build a Trump Moscow. and possibly fix relations between the countries by showing everyone that commerce and business are much better and more practical than politics. That should be Putin's message as well, and we will help him agree on that message. Help world peace and make a lot of money. I would say that's a great lifetime goal for us to go after. Sincerely, Felix Sater. Trump signed the letter of intent almost immediately, according to Cohen's statement to ABC News. By signing a document already signed by a Russian investor, Trump thereby agreed in principle to make Trump World Tower Moscow happen by commingling business and politics. Building the tower, said Sater, would fix relations between Russia and the United States, implying, moreover, that politics was improved rather than compromised when overlaid with commerce and business, which Sater called better and more practical than politics on its own. Trump's signature authorized Sater to begin trying to, as he had said in his note, convince Vladimir Putin to agree on a political message that would gloss over the quid pro quo implicit in the Trump-Rozov deal. As Trump had for months been advocating better relations with Putin, Sater's proposal that Trump simultaneously help world peace and make a lot of money was consistent with the juxtaposition of ambitions the businessman had long ago embraced. The peace, Sater proposed, was to be won by Trump capitulating to the Kremlin on foreign policy as a political candidate, and, if he won, President of the United States. What would follow was making a lot of money. On November 3rd, Sater writes Cohen to say, "I know how to play it, and we will get this done. Buddy, our boy can become President of the United States of America, and we can engineer it. I will get all of Putin's team to buy in on this." As reported by Natasha Bertrand for Business Insider on September 8, 2017, Trump World Tower Moscow was to be built in Moscow City, the Russian capital's nominal financial district. Sater's November 3rd email is notable in several respects. First, in it, a Trump business partner claimed ready access to the President of Russia and his top aides. Second, Sater connected, for reasons unclear at the time, Putin's patronage of Trump and the probability of Trump being able to win the presidency. And third, Sater committed to paper that a single real estate deal, with Trump on one end and, it appears, Putin's team on the other, would allow a presidential election's outcome to be engineered. In an August 2017 interview with the Huffington Post, Cohen claimed to have spoken with Trump about the Trump World Tower Moscow deal only three times, despite the fact that his friend Sater had, by then, been working on such a deal with Trump's knowledge for 12 years. More puzzlingly, Cohen told the Huffington Post that Trump was barely aware of the details of the project from its inception to its termination, a period of time we now know from a May 2018 Yahoo News report was 9 months, from the fourth month of Trump's presidential run to the month he clinched the Republican nomination. As Yahoo News noted at the time, Cohen had previously said in a statement to Congress that he'd given up on the project in January 2016. Only once prosecutors and congressional investigators acquired Cohen's text messages and emails did they discover that he'd made false statements on that score. Sater confirmed to Yahoo News that he had provided all of his texts and emails to and from Cohen to special counsel Robert Mueller's team, as well as to the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and the Senate's Intelligence and Judiciary Committees. But perhaps the most unlikely fact Cohen fed to the Huffington Post in his August 30, 2017 interview was that in the many months he'd been working on the Trump World Tower Moscow project for Trump, he'd spoken with Trump about it for a total of only 4 minutes, and that in the first and third of the three conversations, the businessman had said a total of 4 words, all monosyllabic. Investigators are unlikely to find either claim plausible, particularly in light of Cohen's widely professed loyalty to Trump during the period the statements were made, and the confirmation by 2018 that Cohen had provided inaccurate testimony to Congress on the same subject. By November, Sater has lined up financing for the Trump-Rozoff Tower with VTB, a then-sanctioned Kremlin-owned bank. The next month, however, new sanctions are leveled against VTB, meaning that unless Trump wins the presidency and removes Russian sanctions, he will not be able to get the money that Sater has secured for him. Sater's use of VTB for the funding of Trump World Tower Moscow brings an entirely new perspective to NBC News' reporting in June 2017 that the Trump administration was gearing up to lift sanctions on Russia when the president took office, and that, having been given no prior warning of Trump's intentions, the unilateral ending of sanctions on Russia was only avoided by career diplomats at the State Department ginning up pressure in Congress to block the move. Had Trump's long secret plans on Russian sanctions been successful, and while voters knew Trump opposed such sanctions, they didn't know he was prepared to unilaterally lift them upon taking office, VTB would eventually have been freed to release its promised funding for Trump World Tower Moscow. While perhaps Donald Trump Jr. would have managed the project instead of his father, the fact remains that the tower would have been financially feasible and that any returns from the deal would have, in due time, following his presidency, gone to Trump himself. By late 2015, Torshin is hosting two dinners in Moscow for a high-level NRA delegation that includes NRA President David Keene, top NRA donor Joe Gregory, NRA board member Pete Brownell, and Sheriff David A. Clark, a Trump supporter who will later become a key Trump surrogate. They are joined at one of their dinners by Dmitry Rogozin, a hardline deputy to Putin who is at the time and still is under U.S. sanctions. During the delegation's visit, members are also introduced, according to reporting by McClatchy, to other influential Russian government and business figures. It wasn't just the NRA that the Kremlin wanted to invite to Moscow in 2015. Yulia Alfierova, the organizer of the 2013 Miss Universe pageant and an agent of the Agalarovs, themselves Kremlin agents, tweeted at Trump on November 12, 2015, "Donald Trump, are you going to visit Moscow? Many thing to discuss." Alfierova did not follow up her tweet with another, and Trump did not reply to her via Twitter, so what needed to be discussed between Trump and the Agalarovs is unclear. The picture Alfierova posted with her tweet, however, was the same one she had posted 2 years earlier on November 11, 2013. A picture of herself, Trump, Keith Schiller, Emin Agalarov, Phil Ruffin, and another man looking with great interest at something on a computer screen. "Waiting for your business to start in Russia, Mr. Trump," she'd tweeted to Trump at the time, with the hashtags Russia and Moscow, and tagging Emin Agalarov. The implication was that she wanted Trump to come to Russia in 2015 to discuss the very same business he'd been reviewing with Emin Agalarov in 2013, the Trump-Agalarov deal for a Trump Tower Moscow in the Crocus City complex in Russia's capital. Just a few weeks after Alfierova's tweet to Trump, Michael Flynn, a Trump advisor, went to Moscow and met with Vladimir Putin. That Flynn is now cooperating with special counsel Robert Mueller following a guilty plea for having made false statements in December 2017 may help explain why Trump suddenly knows Flynn far less well than he once did. In a May 2017 interview with NBC News, Trump said, "I don't know that I knew Flynn in 2015. Yet Flynn told the Washington Post in 2016 that it was Trump who had requested their August 2015 meeting and who instructed his staff to arrange it. And a New Yorker article notes that the two men connected almost immediately. In August 2015, Flynn went to New York to meet Trump for the first time. They were scheduled to talk for 30 minutes. The conversation lasted 90. Flynn was deeply impressed.
"Indeed," Flynn said to his interviewer of Trump, "I knew in August 2015 he was going to be President of the United States." But in fact, Flynn had more than just one 2015 conversation with Trump. He told the Washington Post in August 2016 that well prior to his official hire by the Trump campaign in February 2016, he consciously made a decision once I felt the country was at such risk to begin advising five of the GOP candidates running for president. They all reached out to me, including Donald Trump. They would ask me about national security, what's happening in the world, my thoughts on particular issues. I met with all of them. Some of them I met with more often. Flynn's advice to the GOP candidates, especially on the subject of Russia, is unknown. However, Flynn had a long history of exhibiting a special affinity for Russia. As The New Yorker outlined in its February 2017 feature on the retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General, in 2013, while still the Defense Intelligence Agency DIA director, Flynn received permission to meet in Moscow with a group of officers from Russia's largest foreign intelligence agency, the GRU. Despite forces within the U.S. government pressuring him not to go to Moscow, Flynn not only insisted on making the trip, but asked to go to Moscow a second time upon his return. His request was denied. According to Stephen Hall, the chief of Russia operations at the CIA at the time, Flynn wanted to build a relationship with his counterparts in the GRU, which seemed, at best, quaint and naive. "Every time we have tried to have some sort of meaningful cooperation with the Russians, it's almost always been manipulated and turned back against us." If indeed Trump reached out to Flynn because of his reputation for seeking cooperation with the Russians, including Russian intelligence, Hall's concern was prescient in this instance as well. Per a March 31, 2017 Guardian article, Flynn went to work for the Kremlin's propaganda outlet RT as soon as he left the DIA in 2014. As if that were insufficient to underscore Flynn's unusual affinity for Russia, the lieutenant general had, while still with the DIA in 2014, been in secret communication, a communication the DIA required him to report, with a Russian-British graduate student, Svetlana Lakova, whom he met in February 2014. While no links between Lakova and Russian intelligence have yet been found, the young woman is nevertheless considered a leading expert on Soviet espionage and was one of two or three non-GRU personnel in the world granted special access to the military intelligence unit's archives. She would therefore have appealed to Flynn on the basis of his seeming obsession with the GRU, whether or not Lakova was a Russian asset seeking to seduce or recruit him. The two were close enough that in one 2014 email, he signed off as General Misha, Russian for Michael. All this had occurred by the time Trump asked his staff to contact Flynn and set up a meeting in August 2015, after which Trump asked Flynn to advise him on national security issues and foreign policy. As The Guardian detailed, Flynn's intersections with Russia were highly unusual for an American general. In 2015 alone, he was paid for two speaking engagements in D.C. sponsored by Russian entities, one of them Kaspersky Lab, a cybersecurity company linked to the Kremlin. Just days after Flynn returned from his dinner with Putin, Putin issued what a May 2017 documentary by Dutch television program Zembla termed almost an endorsement of Trump. At a December 17, 2015 news conference, Putin volunteered that Donald Trump is a talented person and the absolute leader of the presidential race. He wants to move to a different level of relations, to more solid, deeper relations with Russia, and how can Russia not welcome that? We welcome that. Trump responded immediately, telling ABC News in a statement, It is always a great honor to be so nicely complimented by a man so highly respected within his own country and beyond. I have always felt that Russia and the United States should be able to work well with each other towards defeating terrorism and restoring world peace, not to mention trade and all of the other benefits derived from mutual respect. Publicly available Trump-Russia documents and reporting do not tell us whether Flynn being seated next to Putin at the RT Gala was the work of Felix Sater's outreach to Putin's team, or a byproduct of Flynn's known association with Trump, or both. But we do know that American politics was very much on the Russian president's mind during this period. He also invited and sat with at the gala a fringe American politician, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, who would be in a position to spoil a Hillary Clinton victory in a very close 2016 election. Chapter 5. The National Security Advisory Committee, January to March 2016. Summary. In the first 3 months of 2016, Trump assembles a National Security Advisory Committee whose members surprise experts with their absence of qualifications. Several have no relevant national security experience. Others do, but are unknown to professionals in the field. And at least one Trump National Security Advisor expected to be named to the committee, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, is not named at all. A number of Trump's National Security Advisors are the subject of puzzling contacts with the Russians. One was recruited to be a Russian spy by the SVRRF, Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, in 2013. Another had been part of a secret plot to sell Russian arms to Syrian rebels in 2013. Another worked as an analyst for Kremlin-funded propaganda outlet RT in 2015. Another will be approached by a Kremlin agent in Italy just 2 weeks after his engagement on the committee and be asked to serve as an intermediary between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign, an offer to which the Trump advisor will immediately agree. And yet another Trump National Security Advisor, Eric Prince, who, like Flynn, is a shadow advisor never formally recognized by Trump, will secretly meet with a source close to the Kremlin in the Seychelles in 2017. At the first meeting of the committee, one of its members intimates to campaign officials that he is acting as an intermediary for the Kremlin, and he will thereafter be promoted to Trump's speechwriting team. The committee's chairman will be accused of giving false and misleading statements about secret meetings with the Russians, while its director will be accused of giving false statements about changes he made to the GOP platform to benefit the Kremlin. As the committee's director, J.D. Gordon, will tell CNN in 2017, at the first meeting of Trump's National Security Advisory Committee on March 31, 2016, at the Trump International Hotel in D.C., Trump orders the committee to change the GOP platform at the July Republican National Convention in Cleveland in a way that, per the Washington Post, guts its anti-Russia stance on Ukraine. After Gordon successfully changes the party's Ukraine plank at the convention, he will say to CNN's Jim Acosta that this was the language Donald Trump himself wanted and advocated for back in March at the Trump International Hotel. At the same meeting, the Kremlin's new intermediary, George Papadopoulos, reveals to the group, including Trump, that he is working with the Russians to effectuate a Kremlin-Trump backchannel. Reports of what happens next vary wildly, but three attendees at the meeting will later tell special counsel Robert Mueller and congressional committees that neither Sessions nor Trump offered any objections to Papadopoulos's continuing to conduct back-channel negotiations with the Kremlin. When asked in 2017 about the March 31, 2016 meeting and his response to Papadopoulos identifying himself as an agent for the Kremlin, Trump, who recently boasted of having one of the great memories of all time, according to the Washington Post, will say, "I don't remember much about that meeting." The facts.
In the three most critical months of the Republican primary season, after which all Republican presidential contenders except Donald Trump, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and Ohio Governor John Kasich are eliminated, Trump puts together a national security team he calls his National Security Advisory Committee. The overwhelming majority of pre-election back-channel contacts between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin will involve at least one member of the National Security Advisory Committee, Paul Manafort, or both. The pressure on Trump to build a national security advisory apparatus had increased exponentially once he won 10 of the first 17 GOP primaries and caucuses, coming in second in 4 of the remaining 7, and in 2 of those, Alaska and Iowa, missing the top spot by only 3%. In mid-February, however, at a time when